Good evening. Riding with Biden, the former vice president clinches the nomination to take on Trump. The president casts more shade on the election and the post office, and the NYPD rules change that threatens reporters. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Wednesday, August 19th, 2020. Venezuela's Vice President Delcy Rodriguez decorated Cuban doctors for their cooperation in the fight against COVID-19 yesterday. She indicated that over 22,000 members of the Henry Reeve Brigade are deployed in her nation, saving thousands of lives over the last 5 months. As of Wednesday morning, Venezuela had reported 35,697 COVID-19 cases and 297 deaths. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump has ramped up sanctions on Venezuela's state-run oil company, seeking to raise the heat on President Nicolas Maduro, his country already targeted by a crippling U.S. oil embargo. A handful of European and Asian customers have continued taking Venezuelan oil, including companies from Italy, Spain, and Thailand. Trump will reportedly set an October deadline for ending all trade of Venezuelan oil, including swaps and payments of pending debt with crude. And the president of Mali announced his resignation on state television today. The resignation came hours after rebel soldiers stormed the capital. It marked the end of Ibrahim Boubacar Keita's 7-year reign over the West African country. The coup has the apparent support of thousands of Malians who turned out in the capital, Bamako, accusing the government of corruption, while West African leaders denounced the uprising, calling for the release of Keita. There are unknown numbers of U.S. troops in Mali. In 2018, a firefight between U.S. soldiers and local militants injured 4 American soldiers near the capital of Timbuktu. In the United States, Facebook banned about 900 pages and groups and 1,500 ads tied to the pro-Trump conspiracy theory QAnon today. QAnon is an elaborate, unfounded conspiracy theory alleging that President Donald Trump is secretly saving the world from a group of prominent satanic cannibals that run the world. The group has been linked to several violent criminal incidents, including a train hijacking, kidnappings, a police chase, and a murder. QAnon militia movements and violent movements tied to protests will now no longer be allowed to purchase ads on Facebook. A right-wing woman who identifies herself as proud Islamophobe won the Republican primary for a seat in the House of Representatives in Donald Trump's home district of Mar-a-Lago, Florida. Laura Loomer has been banned from Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and ride-sharing services Uber and Lyft. She tweeted in 2018, "Someone needs to create a non-Islamic form of Uber or Lyft because I never want to support another Islamic immigrant driver." She supports Trump, who tweeted this morning, "Great going, Laura. You have a great chance against the Pelosi puppet." Loomer has little chance of winning the heavily Democratic district in the general election. Last week, Trump congratulated Marjorie Taylor Greene, a vocal QAnon conspiracy theorist who won the GOP primary in Georgia's 14th district, where she's expected to win handily. Last night was day 2 of the Democratic National Convention. It was notable for a new take on the traditional roll call vote of the states. Facing the coronavirus pandemic this year, each delegation read its tally from an iconic location in their own state. It was also a chance for New York's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to second the nomination of Bernie Sanders.
Good evening, bienvenidos, and thank you to everyone here today endeavoring towards a better, more just future for our country and our world. In fidelity and gratitude to a mass people's movement working to establish 21st century social, economic, and human rights, including guaranteed health care, higher education, living wages, and labor rights for all people in the United States. A movement striving to recognize and repair the wounds of racial injustice, colonization, misogyny, and homophobia, and to propose and build reimagined systems of immigration and foreign policy that turn away from the violence and xenophobia of our past. A movement that realizes the unsustainable brutality of an economy that rewards explosive inequalities of wealth for the few at the expense of long-term stability for the many, and who organized a historic grassroots campaign to reclaim our democracy. In a time when millions of people in the United States are looking for deep systemic solutions to our crises of mass evictions, unemployment, and lack of health care, en el espíritu del pueblo and out of a love for all people, I hereby second the nomination of Senator Bernard Sanders of Vermont for President of the United States of America.
And that's AOC. Sanders, who was briefly favored to win the nomination during the primaries, garnered over 1,000 votes or delegates, and some states gave a majority of their delegates to Sanders while calling Joe Biden the next president. But the New York region was definitely riding with Biden. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy.
New Jersey.
We've been hit hard by COVID, but we're coming back. But we have to be smart. We have to listen to the experts. And we have to have a president who has a plan. That's why, in memory of all those we've lost, in solidarity with those who are sick or struggling, and in eternal gratitude for our heroic frontline workers, New Jersey cast 5 votes for Senator Bernie Sanders and 139 votes for the next president of the United States, Joe Biden.
And that's New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy. Retired General Colin Powell, who was raised in the South Bronx, also delivered an endorsement.
100 years ago, a young immigrant left a dirt farm in Jamaica and set out for America. 3 years later, a ship pulled into New York Harbor, and a young Jamaican woman gazed up at the Statue of Liberty for the first time. They became my parents, and they inspired me to finish college and join the Army. This began a journey of service that would take me from basic training to combat in Vietnam, up the ranks to serve as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Secretary of State. The values I learned growing up in the South Bronx and serving in uniform were the same values that Joe Biden's parents instilled in him in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I support Joe Biden for the presidency of the United States because those values still define him, and we need to restore those values to the White House.
Retired General Colin Powell. And New York registered nurse and 1199 union member Sheena Iyande Tanis coined a campaign theme as she announced the Empire State's tally.
As an immigrant from St. Vincent and the Grenadines and an 1199 SEIU registered nurse, I am proud to be part of America's fight against COVID-19. But many healthcare workers don't get paid sick leave or have enough protective equipment. I have 2 children with asthma and a mother who's high risk. I worry every day about bringing this virus home to them. Joe Biden's plan will help us take better care of your loved ones as well as our own. Along with Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul, I cast New York's votes. 44 votes for Bernie Sanders and 277 for our next president, Joe Biden. It's Joe time.
New York delegate Sheena Iyande Tanis. Tonight's Democratic Convention highlight will be a speech from Senator Kamala Harris, the vice presidential nominee. The theme, a more perfect union. And President Trump has reportedly been watching the proceedings avidly and angrily. Trump on Monday cast doubt on the election process, claiming falsely that the only way he would lose in November is if the election is rigged. His press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, defended Trump's comment today.
The president has always said he'll see what happens and make a determination in the aftermath. It's the same thing he said last November. He wants a free election, a fair election, and he wants confidence in the results of the election, particularly when you have states like Nevada doing mass mail out voting to their voting rolls. And when they tried this in the primary, it was a massive failure. Ballots were piled up in trash cans. Ballots were pinned to apartment dartboards. And with that being the system, the president wants to take a hard look at this and make sure that these are fair election results and not subject to fraud.
Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany. Turmoil at the U.S. Postal Service is causing some Democrats and local election officials to rethink their vote-by-mail strategies for November's presidential election. The emphasis is moving towards drop boxes and early voting that bypass the post office. Democrats in battleground states, including Pennsylvania, are particularly concerned about ballots arriving too late to count for the November 3rd election. On Tuesday, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy announced he was suspending cost-counting counting measures he had put in place in recent weeks, but some Democrats said the damage is already done. The author of Preserving the People's Post Office is Christopher Shaw. He says Trump is undercutting public confidence in the Postal Service.
The moves by the new Postmaster General are undermining confidence in the Postal Service, and this is a manufactured crisis, and it is a way to try to make people think that a government service that has worked very successfully for more than two centuries is faltering, and it's a move towards corporatizing it and perhaps ultimately trying to privatize it.
As a historian, have you ever seen anything like this? Has there ever been any sustained criticism or attack on the post office like we're seeing now in history?
It's unprecedented for an administration to be openly critical of the Postal Service's ability to perform its mission in this way.
Is that reflecting more Trump's desire to screw up the election in November, or is that reflecting problems that have developed in the post office?
It's our one universal means of communication. Not everyone has access to the internet or uses the internet. It's also becoming more important to our economy. As e-commerce continues to grow, there's 30,000 post offices in small towns and big cities across the country, and they play a central role in community life and in community identity in lots of small towns and villages. For all these reasons, it really is an essential universal service that a government agency provides and we're all depending on.
Donald Trump has over and over again attacked things that are crucial to his own base, if you count that as rural America.
We've all taken the post office for granted, and this is making people see just how important it is. And also, service is over 90%, and it's just there's across-the-board approval of it, and you're starting to see some pushback from some Republicans from Montana, for instance. I mean, especially Republicans from rural areas who know what the attack on the U.S. mail means to their constituencies. There is a political price here. Republicans are beginning to question what's going on.
What kind of damage could this do, though?
This could provide a justification for contracting out more, for ultimately moving in a privatization direction towards curtailing the service even more. Because if people don't think that it can continue to deliver, if they lose their faith in the U.S. mail, then they're going to use it less, and this is going to undermine the Postal Service going down the road.
What's the idea of having the post office, and how does that fit in with American individualism?
The post office actually predates July 4th, 1776. It starts in 1775. And the distinctive thing about the American post office is that in comparison to other nations, it always stressed the idea of service, of extending service rather than making money. And certainly that is not something that Ayn Rand and libertarians support, the idea of this kind of a government service. And so that's why it's been in their crosshairs for many decades, especially starting in the 1970s, when you have a lot of libertarian think tanks that get funded by wealthy individuals and corporations. And they begin this campaign against the Postal Service, saying that it needs to be privatized, that it would be much more efficient if it wasn't, in fact, a government agency.
What kind of society would we have without the post office?
That's exactly the problem, is that the reason the Postal Service is functional is because it, in fact, does serve everybody. And so this means that there's a subsidy from business mailing between major cities to help it so that, that way mail can be delivered to remote areas like Alaska. And if you take away that, what would happen is the whole system would collapse. The Postal Service, it's a symbol of nationhood. A lot of people have patriotic feelings towards it. It just seems like this began when he was upset with Amazon because they own the Washington Post, and he doesn't like the Washington Post's coverage. And Amazon has a big contract with the post office. But at this point, it does call into question the validity of the election. And I think that's a really troubling prospect for democracy.
Christopher Shaw is author of Preserving the People's Post Office. Shaw adds the Postal Service may become the key institution for delivering COVID testing kits to millions of Americans in the near future. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo, and this story just in over the wire, the United States will demand Thursday that all United Nations sanctions be reimposed against Iran. President Donald Trump said Wednesday, a move that follows America's embarrassing defeat to extend an arms embargo against Tehran. The administration's insistence on snapping back international sanctions against Iran sets the stage for a contentious dispute. It's possible that the U.S. call will be ignored by other U.N. members, an outcome that could call into question the U.N. Security Council's ability to enforce its own legally binding decisions. It's a snapback, Trump said on Wednesday. And United Federation of Teachers President Michael Mulgrew said at a news conference today, New York City teachers are prepared to strike if schools reopen before they feel it's safe. Currently, the city is planning on a September 10th start date for returning to class. Mulgrew said, if we feel that a school is not safe, we are prepared to go to court and take a job action. In a statement, the union says, in the event of a positive COVID-19 case, the unions are calling for the immediate closure of that school building and a return to remote learning for 14 days before reopening. Meanwhile, Governor Andrew Cuomo announced the 12th straight day of New York showing below 1% for COVID-19 positive tests. Addressing school reopening, the governor says he wants schools to take into account what has been seen in other elementary and high schools. He mentioned Notre Dame University, where 130 students were tested positive in 1 week.
On a college, in some ways it's not as bad, because the student was infecting other students. K-12, if you had 130 students positive, it's not 130. It's 500, because a student would have gone home and dealt with people in their immediate family. You know, in some ways, being on a college campus is less problematic from a spread point of view than K-12. But I want the schools to take this situation into consideration and answer the question, would this have happened in your school? Could you have caught the spread before it got to 130 students? And if you can't answer yes, then there's a problem. But the basic point on both is opening schools, risky and problematic. That happens in September. In September, the flu season starts, going to make it much harder to diagnose symptomatic people, going to make some people sick, which will then make them in a more serious situation if they get COVID, and then it's going to really stress our testing capacity. That all happens in a matter of weeks. This is not over. The second wave is coming. It's going to be more challenging. On top of that, we still have states all around us getting infected and quarantine facilities and procedures and lack of compliance in bars and restaurants, which if I had to guess, that lack of compliance is going to be transferred to college campuses all across the state. And we still have local police departments that are not stepping up and doing their job.
Governor Andrew Cuomo. And a rule change proposal for the New York City Police Department has reporters all over the city nervously gripping their police issued press passes. The NYPD is proposing changes to the rules on the suspension or revocation of press credentials. The policy changes specify that a reporter's credentials, which allow reporters behind police lines when reporting the news, could be suspended if they're arrested, though not necessarily convicted, or fail to comply with a lawful order of a police officer, and if they attempt to interfere with a police officer's official function. Although the rule change comes on the heels of a reporter's lawsuit over a cop pulling his pass for no reason, most reporters and civil rights activists say there are dangers to the First Amendment looming. Claire Regan is president of the Deadline Club.
New York City Police Department scheduled a public hearing about proposed rule changes governing press credentials for journalists in New York City. It actually turned into more of a an opportunity for solidarity among New York City journalists.
Why the solidarity? Why is it necessary?
There have been numerous examples recently of journalists feeling that they've been mistreated, pushed away, abused even at certain scenes. And so the public hearing gave them a chance to air those grievances to the police department.
What is the process for journalists to get press credentials? And in a country where you have freedom of the press, why do you even need them?
In New York City, journalists must apply for press credentials through the New York City Police Department at One Police Plaza on the 13th floor through the Office of DCPI, Deputy Commissioner of Public Information. The application process requires you to supply clips to show that you do need to cross police and fire lines for your assignments, a letter from your supervisor, and there are certain requirements for what kind of a news organization you belong to. The cards have to be renewed. They're renewable as well. They expire and have to be renewed. It's a pretty arduous process. Once you get a police press card from the NYPD, it's a little easier to get it renewed, but you still have to show reason to hold one.
Are they trying to actually prevent reporters from reporting on what's happening at these protests and these demonstrations?
That's the feeling that a lot of journalists get, and that's what the evidence sort of points to. And that's why we heard a lot of those examples come to light at the hearing yesterday. Almost every journalist at the hearing had a story to tell about how they were held back or even pushed, shoved, or they considered assaulted by the police department.
There were arrests, too,
weren't
there?
Yes, exactly. And then, you know, the issue for the hearing is the confiscation of a police press card, which is really that's the livelihood for a journalist, is their press card. Once that's taken away, that journalist can't do their job. And a couple of journalists at the hearing spoke about that as well. The police can summarily, sort of arbitrarily, just confiscate, take away a police card on the scene. And it's sort of a, you know, split-second judgment call made by that officer at that moment, which is what journalists have the most trouble with. You know, it could be a chaotic scene. Of course, journalists know that police officers are trying to protect them from being injured, but it's the arbitrary judgment and the confiscation of the card. There should be, you know, I think the journalists hope that there would be other options besides just taking the card away at that moment.
Right.
Rendering them unable to stay there on the scene and do their job.
Under these new rules, they can permanently remove your press pass. If you're arrested,
it's confiscation and revocation. Those two words are part of the new rule. You know, there's a hearing process spelled out in the proposed rules. It's a big delay where the journalists can't do their job without their credentials while the police department holds them and revokes them or confiscates them and before the hearing is held. So it's almost like a journalist is guilty before being proven guilty. The best case scenario is to cooperate. But the police department, journalists cooperate with each other, respect each other. We would like to see a balance of power at scenes between the police and the press.
They seem like licensing of a reporter's.
Yes, it does seem like that. It seems like there's an imbalance of power. Most of the journalists I heard at the hearing yesterday, they're talking about different situations handled in different ways by different police officers. There seems to be no training on how to deal with journalists at the scene, and it just depends on the moment, the people involved, the officers involved, and that's the arbitrary part of this whole situation.
Enemies of the people, that's famously what Donald Trump called the media. Do you think you get that feeling from the NYPD that they're treating reporters as enemies of the people?
Yeah, I think journalists are feeling that challenge more than ever.
Wasn't there something about the City Hall or some other agency taking over press passes?
Yes, Paul. Some journalists have suggested that perhaps an outside organization or agency would be better. The journalists would be better served by applying for press credentials through another agency. The mayor's press office has been suggested as an agency because what's happening now is the police department is issuing credentials for their own scenes that they supervise. So journalists feel like that's a conflict of interest, and especially if they're in charge of confiscating and revoking.
Claire Regan is president of the Deadline Club, the city's chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, August 19th, 2020. The news is produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson from New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News. Thanks for joining us.